Hey everyone, and welcome to This Lesbian Ship is Intense. I'm Katie.
And I'm V.
And today we are going to be talking to you about the movie The Half of It, written and directed by the wonderful Alice Wu. Hope y'all are doing okay out there in quarantine land.
You know, just consume all that gay media you don't have time to watch. That's fine. That's how I'm using my quarantine time.
I literally only watch gay shit right now, but I also feel like it makes me feel still like I'm part of a community, even though I'm literally by myself all the time now.
I'm trying to dive back into fandom so that I feel not so alone.
Exactly. But it's like really wonderful how gay people have always created their own communities.
Oh, also, if you're looking for something to entertain you during the quarantine, maybe you'd be interested in one of the podcasts in the Frolic Network as well. So here's a promo.
Well, hello there. I'm Sarah Wendell from Smart Podcast Trashy Books, part of the Frolic Podcast Network. Smart Podcast focuses on romance fiction, the nifty folks who read it and write it, and always what books we're reading and want to tell you about. It might be an expensive podcast to listen to, but I promise great recommendations and conversations every week. We have talks about burnout with educators like Amelia and Emily Nagoski. We have gossip sessions with authors like Nalini Singh, and we're always having a good time, and I'd love it if you joined us. New episodes arrive every Friday, and you can find Smart Podcast Trashy Books on your favorite podcast app.
You can keep up with us on our Twitter, at This Lesbian Shit, our Instagram, at This Lesbian Ship, and then also follow, download, rate, subscribe, all that jazz on iTunes. Interact with us, because like we said, we're lonely.
Yes, be our community.
The Half of It, Alice Wu, one of our favorites. She did Saving Face originally, which is one of my favorite gay rom-coms of all time. So I was super excited when this movie came out, and she did not let me down.
No, I have a lot of feelings of just feeling grateful to Alice and just thinking about the idea that if you want to see yourself, maybe you need to be the person who like creates it. And so like, I'm just so grateful for what Alice did, what like 15 years ago with Saving Face. I'm so glad for what she did today. The fact that it makes me feel so represented even all these years later. And I don't know, it makes me think about how you and I do this podcast because we wanted to give a queer voice to these shows that we like consuming.
Right. And it's so interesting to watch a traditional coming of age movie being told entirely from a queer perspective about love. And I think that's why I love this movie so much, even though it's not a traditional rom-com, it's a coming of age movie. I was contemplating this last night and I came to the realization that like coming of age movies era is like literally how I define my personality. It's like so much of it's like so much of who I am today. Every Friday, my parents would take us to Blockbuster and we would pick out our little movie to watch. And, you know, that's how I found myself, was through this. Like, I that's why I still love teenage shows, like teenage dramas, even though I'm a grown ass woman.
I agree with you. This is a great description of you, like how these types of shows and movies developed you.
These sorts of movies are all about the trying and the learning and the growing and about becoming you. And that's something I struggled with for all of my youth, like becoming who I truly was inside. And so I found myself in these movies.
You mentioned this being like a queer coming of age movie. And I think that it's also really important to point out that it is a queer person of color. And I think that's really important.
People, both of them.
Yes, it's true. Yeah. So like for me, a big part of what resonated for me, I think, was more so actually the being a minority than being gay, because I was late to life to the realization that I'm gay.
Yeah, it was actually so relatable to me because this is something like I shoved down for almost my entire high school career. And then the summer after I graduated high school, it's like, holy shit, you're gay. You need to deal with this. So, like, the timing was really sensitive for me.
It's like your body said you're out of high school, you're safe. Like, you exactly. deal with this now.
It's a lot. Not to get into my own traumas.
And I would be remiss not to mention the fact that, as some of you may know, I'm Mexican and my wife is Chinese, and we watched this film together. There's so much I know that she related to in a film that so very well depicted her own experiences as a Chinese American girl growing up in a predominantly white suburb.
This movie is so brilliant, and it sets up its brilliance in that opening scene. Mm-hmm. With the narration, because, you know, the whole story is that the gods split a person that had two of everything in half, and that you're searching for this other half. It's a sense of longing. How lesbianic. Longing is just the most lesbian thing in the world. But also, because you were separated, humans had to find another way to survive. So they learn to find love in many things and many people.
I mean, like, I don't know how I feel about this whole idea of, like, soulmates and stuff. But I think that society very much tells us that in order to be a whole person, there needs to be another person. And we very yeah. much assume that that other person has to be a romantic partner, the person you're going to marry and have kids with and do all of these things that you're supposed to do. And I really love the exploration of how love exists in so many ways and fulfills you, even if it's not that romantic love.
As a twin, I've never had that feeling, really, because I feel like I was born with my soulmate. I just really love the whole concept of this, being that soulmates exist, but you need to knock down those walls where you've always believed in this one way, where, like, one person you meet across your journey can be your soulmate. You might have many of them.
As we first meet Ellie, we see her not as a whole person. You know, like, we get to see her computer, we get to see her, the back of her, we get to see her writing. And so we don't see her as a whole person. And I loved how Alice elaborates on the fact that this was a very intentional choice. Ellie Chu is the kind of person who doesn't see herself as a protagonist of any story, let alone her own story. So as I watched this, I was thinking, you know, what is Ellie's concept of herself? Her concept of herself is, you know, what she does for other people, what she produces, but it's not who she is as her own person. One of the other quotes I think Alice has given in interviews has been that part of writing this is that Ellie Chu in any other TV show or movie would be the background character. We would never get any insight into who she is as a person, as to what makes her tick, what does she care about, what does she love, because minorities are not the main characters in a lot of television and movies. And that really, really hit me.
That adds so much depth to Ellie as a character and why I love her so much, because Ellie, on the extreme surface level, is that background character in that she fits all of these stereotypes. But from the first second Ellie starts talking, she breaks so many of them in the same breath. Alice throughout this whole movie is always challenging the superficial and going deeper. While Ellie is the protagonist, she's also kind of calling Ellie out because she sees Aster as the protagonist.
Yeah.
But through that whole journey, she only knows the half of it. She doesn't fully know Aster until the end.
Speaking of some other things, like just kind of like setup, I personally really, really, really love the way Ellie is portrayed. Like, I look at her and I'm like, oh, hey, you're a teenager in high school.
Yes. Like,
this feels true to like what I was like in high school.
You know, Leah Lewis is a discovery. She is brilliant in this, in my opinion. She gives Ellie so much depth.
Yes, very true. Ellie is riding her bicycle to school, and we see a truck full of kids drive past, and they yell, chugga, chugga, choo, choo. She does not get fazed at all, which indicates to us that this is a common occurrence, which is annoying but not unbelievable.
It has affected her sense of self in a way, but it's also not something that really beats her down. She's just like, yeah, I'm smart. I write you all essays. Like, this is my
life.
I'm gonna
capitalize off y'all dumbasses.
Yeah. She's like, at least I'm fucking smart, bitch. Like,
yes. So we go to the band room, and this is where we learn that Ellie writes these papers for her peers. So she's like, you know, conducting business during class, and all of her peers are gossiping and chatting, and she's kind of off to the side, kind of on her own. We see that Ellie is just like watching Aster, who is sitting next to her boyfriend, and she's kind of isolated too. The way that they've positioned it, you know, Trig is turned towards his peers and they're all chatting, and Aster's kind of sitting on her own. And then they start to sing a song, and I thought it was interesting that the lyrics of the song that Aster was singing as Ellie was watching her were, "You fill up my senses." Ellie is clearly consumed by Aster, and like, that's already like, this girl's got it for her.
I think this is something that's very underrated about Alexis's performance and how Alice directs Aster. You are able to get in this very scene a sense of like command and confidence and regalness about Aster, how to see her through Ellie and Paul's eyes. Through Alexis's performance, you can see that Aster does not relate to that at all. She feels empty and disconnected by that spot. And I think that's really set from this moment when she starts the song. Does Aster's dad literally do everything in this town? He's the music teacher, he's the preacher, and he owns that restaurant?
Oh my God, you're right.
I'm like, holy shit, what doesn't he not do? That would fucking suck if your teacher was your preacher. Lord.
So then we move into, I guess, what is the English class? It's that teacher. I don't know what her name is, but it's a teacher who knows that Ellie is writing all of these papers for all of her peers, but, you know, isn't calling her out on it because otherwise she'd have to read their shit.
We need to appreciate Ellie's level of genius here. Like, but for her to be able to write 6 different essays about the same subject.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I could barely do one.
I know. I was like, I can't even figure out my own opinion on shit. How am I going to write 6 other opinions?
Like, she is a true genius.
Ellie consumes a lot, and so she can spout out all of these different ideas, but what is truly her own understanding, she may not really know that herself. So I think that's also an interesting take on Ellie and her like essay writing business and who she is as a person.
I don't think Ellie's ever fully confronted with where she stands on things until after.
Yes. So the teacher ends up talking to her about going to Grinnell, I think is how you pronounce it, some college in Iowa. And Ellie says something that really, really resonates with me where she's like, I'm going to get a full ride here. Like, I'm not going to go to this school. And like, honestly, that's why I went to college where I did. I got a full fucking ride and I couldn't afford to pay for shit. So like, that's where I went. And that's really realistic for some people.
Getting out of a small town is not easy, no matter how smart you are, especially if you come from a town where you're the minority, like Ellie. Like, it's not like her dad has connections all over the place. Her family is so small because she's an immigrant.
Ellie is riding her bicycle home, and we see Paul, who is chasing after her, and for some reason thinks it's a good idea to hold onto her damn bike crate to, like, get her to stop. And so she falls, and she's like, what the fuck, man? I think he hands her the letter, and she's like, okay, it's $10 for this or whatever the hell. And he's like, I'm not trying to cheat. And she's like, no one is. And for some reason, that made me laugh so hard because, like, how many times do people kind of say something like this where they're like, I'm not trying to cheat, I'm not trying to do this, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, no, that's exactly what you're doing, dude. She opens up the letter and sees that it's to Aster and immediately is like, nope, can't do that. And her reasoning being like, it's a letter, it should be authentic. But really, it's like, I can't talk to Aster.
She can't put herself out of her comfort zone in that way.
So we go home and we see that the lights are flickering in the house, which kind of gives us an indication of maybe like some financial issues. And we have Ellie, who talks to her father in Mandarin, asks, you know, have you talked to the electric company? And he says, no, they don't understand my accent.
You know, when he talks, they show him having a good accent.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the whole point. It doesn't matter how hard you try. If people don't want to open up their minds, they're never going to. Ellie's dad to have a PhD and achieve something that's so difficult and to then be put into this box. I mean, I can't imagine what that's like for him.
I remember watching this interview for something, but this guy was talking in another language and he was saying, just because I don't speak your language well does not mean that I'm stupid. And I thought that was so important for Ellie's father. He's got a fucking PhD, but because he doesn't speak perfect English, his accent is really great and his grammar is really great. And like later on when we hear from Paul where he's like, I don't speak good either. Like there are plenty of people whose first language is English who do not speak well. And the racism behind that just gives me a lot of feelings.
Well, also the idea that language equates intelligence when it's all bullshit to begin with. It's just rules somebody came up with. But, you know, we also get what it turns out to be one of the most moving storylines of this movie, where Alice really lays the groundwork here, where Ellie's dad focuses on the best part of the movie. Those are some of the moments where he looks the happiest.
So then we go to Ellie at school, where she is not only having to deal with all of her age-appropriate shit, but she's also having to deal with adult shit where she's calling the electricity company. She bumps into Aster and drops all her shit. And I thought it was really hilarious when Aster says, hallways are murder. And I was like, you're going to be murder. Like, she cannot handle talking to you, Aster. This is too overwhelming. And Ellie just says, like, I'm Ellie too. Like, just like freaks out.
They're basically showing you that Ellie has had to grow up very fast and become an adult, because every adult watching that like relates to Ellie so much in that moment, but she's in a fucking high school. And they're setting up both Aster and Ellie's journey in this moment, because both of their journeys are about barely repressed longing. Ellie longing for Aster and longing for that true love, and Aster longing for a life that's different than the one she's been boxed into.
It's interesting to me that they are both aware of each other. So Ellie introduces herself and Aster's like, I know who you are. You've been playing piano at church for the past 4 years. And I think it's interesting how much Aster is aware of her. They talk a little bit about the book, which is about barely repressed longing, which again is more foreshadowing. And we find out that she needs $50 for the electricity, and she sees Paul and is like, hey, I'll do it. It's $50. So that is how this, you know, Cyrano thing starts. They're in a church and she's reading Paul's letter, which just makes me fucking die, because Paul's just like, you're pretty, you're smart. I'd still love you if you were not pretty.
But you know what's great about it to me is you don't understand this yet, but Paul is so earnest in his narration when he's fucking talking about French fries, dipping it in a milkshake. And it's so true to who Paul is. Like, mm-hmm. It's really nice. But Ellie's like, what the fuck? Like, you, how do you know that you're in love with her? I don't get that at all based off of this letter.
Yeah, Ellie's a realist. And she's just like, you've never spoken to her. How the hell do you know that you're in love with her? And Paul's all feelings. Paul's like, I wake up, I think of her. I go to bed, I think of her. Like, that's love. And he's like, oh, shit, you've never been in love. And Ellie gets upset. And she is like, you want a love letter? I'll write you a damn love letter.
But what's interesting is the line of dialogue they choose to play on the movie, which is longing. Longing for a wave of love to swell up in me. The quote to start this next bit of the movie, in love, one always starts by deceiving oneself and ends by deceiving others. That is what the world calls a romance. So we're jumping right into the deception. And we get this montage kind of where we are learning about how there's so much more a part of each other than they know yet. They really see themselves as completely different people, but we're seeing like these similarities in their life.
Some quotes from Aster's letter where she says, you know, that she doesn't really show anything that she feels really. She talks about how she feels like she's a nobody because she's so popular and so paid attention to, and people want to make her like them, and she's not an individual. Whereas Ellie feels like a nobody because she's so isolated in her experience.
You know, I just really loved that montage that they do with the walking down the hall, where someone else on the outside would view her on top of the world, but she views herself as out of place. They do some direct symbolism where she's always surrounded by all these girls that look exactly the same. and she looks completely different. So layered, like it's like, okay, she's the only person of color, but Aster could kind of be passing.
Mm-hmm.
But Aster never fully wants to conform, even though she does. And I think that's so interesting.
Yeah, I agree. The way that they kind of show her to be like them, but not really like them. On Tumblr, they talked about how Aster's kind of privilege in her world is provisional, that she doesn't truly belong and it can be taken away. And I thought it was interesting. So then Ellie's in the restroom and Aster goes in and Ellie's washing her hands. And I just really enjoyed the way, like, you can feel them kind of drawn to each other, but like they can't really look at each other while these girls are talking about small town shit.
I just love the concept with it being a mirror. This is a moment of connection in this world that they're feeling for each other, but people don't see what they're not looking for, even though there's literally a mirror connecting them.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that quote. And I was like, the way that she doesn't see Ellie in these letters, just because later on she's like, I should have known kind of thing. Like, she probably should have. but anyways, those girls say some kind of like, you know, rude things about Esther's family and Aster walks off. So then they end up talking about paintings and Aster shares this quote or this like lesson that she learned, like there's five strokes between a good painting and a great painting, and a bold stroke can make it great or it can ruin it. And, you know, do you choose to be bold? She talks about how she gave up painting and it's kind of how she lives her life now. And it's probably a good life that she'd have in Squamish. And I just really, really fucking related to this shit because like, damn, I'd be married with babies with my high school ex. Like, if I had not made a bold stroke and left.
You know, and I just think that's such a concept that's hard to come to terms with in adulthood. That the only way your life moves forward is if you take those bold strokes. But you never know which five it's going to be. Sometimes those aren't the right ones and you have to find different ones. And that's like the fucking lesson of life, man. That's hard to grasp because sometimes you do something and you just want to know why you did that.
I think about some of the scariest shit I've done in my life and like, God, how easily like shit could have been real bad. But fortunately turned out really great,
which is like a perfect analogy into this whole game that they play and painting on this wall.
Oh, I love this, Katie.
Oh my God, I just really love it. They like play this game of challenging each other, and Aster like fully commits and like creates this piece of art. But the piece of art is not just the art, it's the conversation they had about it. It's about that connection to each other. And then, you know, when they finally feel like they achieve that, the wall's painted over. Ellie's, it says everything beautiful is ruined eventually. And I just like really love that because even though it's true that it's so hard to sustain that beautiful moment forever, it never leaves you. Like it's still there, even if it's something else now.
Yes, I loved it so much because, one, I think that it's very realistic for, like, who Ellie is to feel like, yes, these beautiful things exist, but they don't last. And the pain of that, considering the loss of her mother and the existence that she has in Squamish. And then I also love it because I feel like it's so important to understand, make that bold stroke and do something terrifying, because if you get something that's amazing, you get to enjoy that shit while it exists. And just because it's end doesn't mean that it's awful. There will be another great, beautiful thing that you can create. You know, like this is not the one and only thing. So they are writing letters back and forth to each other. And Paul is like, let's get burgers. So he ends up texting Aster against Ellie's wishes while Aster is watching Trig do some mudding.
Oh, my God. I love how wonderfully awful Trig is. It feels so true to life. But like Paul reaches out and texts her with like 50 emojis, which is like, of course he would. Yeah. And what's interesting about the framing of Aster surrounded by all of these people that look the same, although Aster conforms, she was always meant to stand out. And that's what she's learning through her journey in this movie. And she's learning how to do that.
Some questions around username. So like, okay, so Astra starts responding and then stops, and then Ellie's like, yeah, fucked it up, dude. So then she says like, oh, my little whoever got into my phone, let's move this somewhere safe, and they go onto this other app. Ellie already has a username, which is Smith Corona.
What is that? I have no idea.
So I Googled it, and it is a like label manufacturer.
That can't be the reference.
I know. I was like, is it like a typewriter? Oh, you know what? There is a Smith Corona typewriter. So it may be a reference to that. And then her username is Diego Rivero, which is she swaps the last letters on Diego Rivera, which is the husband of Frida Kahlo. So I thought that was interesting that she chose his name instead of Frida's. I don't know that I have any thoughts about it other than, huh.
There's got to be some good character analysis to that that we're not capable of. So we're just going to move along.
Yes.
So then Paul and Aster go on their date. And my favorite thing, this is genius to me, how Paul goes, it's a date, not a book report. And then the first thing after gives him is a book. Oh, yes. My God.
Oh, it's hilarious.
That shows how much Ellie and Aster understand each other.
Yeah, and how much they connect. It's the book that Ellie was reading at the beginning of the film, too. She mentioned something about her father being strict and people talking. And I remember paying attention to that because I was thinking about how much Aster isn't able to show what she thinks and feels because, I mean, she's just really not allowed to. It's like it's an awkward date. She calls him a friend at one point. He talks about Ready Whip. Like, I don't know.
Paul is out of his element. They don't have anything in common.
I don't know. I love it. It's a disaster.
It's endearing. It's very endearing.
He is so endearing.
I love Paul so much.
One of the things that I tweeted about this, I was just like, how the fuck did you do this, Alice, where you made me care about a straight white guy? Like,
there's so much about Paul and Ellie's connection that I feel with one of my like best guy friends.
So Ellie tells him that the date was a disaster, and he is like, no, I think he's like, it's gonna be fine. I don't know. But I remember the truck goes by again, and Paul chucks a rock at them. And I'm like, aw, thanks, Paul.
The look on Ellie's face when he does that, I feel like this is one of the first moments where Ellie realizes that maybe she needs to look at Paul in a different light.
So Aster messages him that it was a weird date, and he's like, I will pay you double, like, let's continue this.
Paul talks about how he's trying, and Ellie says there are no points for effort, and Paul says, isn't that what love is? How much effort you put into loving someone? And oh my God, I just found that to be one of the most beautiful lines in this movie, because it's interesting that that's Paul's concept. Because that is how he loves Ellie. Like, he puts all this effort into understanding her and giving her support. He believes truly in the romance of love, but he also understands that it doesn't exist in a vacuum.
Yeah, I think it's really, really important because I think, unfortunately, a lot of people have this belief that, like, love is the end all be all and that love will fix and solve everything. And like, you can love someone, but that does not mean that it does not work. Like, you gotta work. Then she ends up, I think, telling him, like, you're in training. And so she uses this to train him on how to have a not shitty date with Aster, how to communicate with her better.
And as they have this conversation, the thesis statement to Aster's character is playing in the background, where on the TV it plays a woman saying, I don't want to be worshipped, I want to be loved.
Oh shit, I didn't even notice that. And that is
there
good.
Are so many fucking nuggets in this movie that I'm obsessed with.
Oh damn. So a couple of things. I'm pretty sure this is like kind of montage-y. So she mentions that they're having a conversation about who's the better Hepburn. He talks to her about the taco sausage. They play ping pong, which is a metaphor for conversation.
Which I'm going to use if I ever have to talk to someone about how to have a conversation.
Yeah, it's a great metaphor. Yeah. So they go to the movie theater and Aster's there. It's a horror, but she's laughing, which I just think is really funny.
Oh my God, that's when I knew I would love Aster.
They do this like little interview with Trig, like good cop, bad cop. And I just have to bounce back to the taco sausage thing.
If I wasn't a vegetarian, I feel like I would be obsessed with the taco sausage. That shit looked good.
Okay, well, I have a question. I saw this and I was like, this is a poor Mexican's hot dog. Like, this is like when my mom had hot dogs in the house and we didn't buy special fucking rolls for hot dogs. She'd put it in a fucking corn tortilla. Like, that's what that is. So I've talked to my wife about this a lot because I'm like, what the fuck is this? And she said that she thinks that the sausage itself is made with seasonings to taste like a, you know, taco.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's what it is. I think because there's like guacamole on it. Like there, it's Yeah.
Oh my God, I did not pay enough attention. I thought it was just a fucking sausage and a tortilla, and I was like, that's just a hot dog.
No. But it's like, it's supposed to be this white boy's interpretation, so you think it's not good when it's more layered than you think it is.
Oh, okay, well, this makes me feel better. But anyways.
I fucking think that looks delectable. Like, replace that shit with some tofu and let me try it. They're spying on Astor's family having dinner, and that's when Paul tries to really understand Ellie for the first time, and Ellie misreads it at first and thinks that he's judging her and her family. And we get this really wonderful insight to Paul where he talks about how he fully understands this like concept of no right way out, where he wants to own his new shop with new recipes, but he's the fourth son. So he feels like he has to live up to his mom's expectations so he doesn't break his mom's heart, and how his mom is connected to these recipes because it connects her to her mom. It's such an understanding of the complication of love in that whole sentence, because
yeah.
Nobody's at fault, but you hurt people anyway.
I thought it was also really, really insightful for Paul, someone who struggles so much to articulate his thoughts, for him to be able to say, like, I know that I want to leave, and I also know that I can't, or I feel like I cannot leave. And the reasons being that, you know, I can't go because my family's all here. I can't change the things I want to change while I'm here because that challenges my mother, who has lost her mother, and this is her connection to her. Like, that is intricate. That is intense to understand, even as a teenager. So I thought that was really great of him to be able to say to Ellie, and I think that that really hits her, because then she stays and she talks to him about how, like, you know, her father has a PhD. He's an engineer. He moved from China to Squamish to get a job here, and it was supposed to be a jumping off point, and he was supposed to get promoted, and it didn't happen. And apparently speaking good English trumps a PhD from China, at least. And bitch, the way I wanted to fucking cry with how much this fucking resonates to my life.
In that moment of feeling that pain, you know, it just called back to this time where I was given kind of a wake-up call about that in America. At my first real job, I was working with this doctor who was Filipino. And she goes, you know that most of the nurses in the infirmary are Filipino doctors. Their degrees just didn't transfer here. And that was my first moment of, like, really awakening to the world of injustice. Like, what in the fucking world? Why did their degrees matter less?
My parents weren't married for long, but when my father was around, I remember that he got passed over for promotion opportunities because he didn't have a degree in the field that would be most relevant, but he had years and years of hands-on experience in it. And I remember growing up, my mother always said to me, go and get that piece of paper so that you can make money and you don't kill yourself the way that we do. And it has stuck with me so hard. And to this day, my mother is so proud that I can fucking take a sick day. She's so proud that I can fucking take a vacation time. How fucking privileged am I that I just feel like that is, duh, I should be able to do that. But for her, that was not a reality. Like, I don't know when my mom ever took a fucking day off. And this shit just, like, it makes me so fucking emotional. I think it's very real, and I very much appreciate Alice putting it in this film.
Paul relates here. This is when we have that moment where he doesn't speak very good either. And there's just something so moving about the scene when Ellie goes, well, what's your excuse? It's acknowledging the racism at play without putting Paul down. And it's such a delicate balance that I really think is executed well. And then Paul invites Ellie over for dinner, but his place is like a event. And so then we go to Ellie's instead.
Yeah, it's just really hilarious, the difference between the two households. Super loud at Paul's, super quiet at Ellie's. So they have their meal there. Then they go to church. I was thinking about what Astor's father was preaching, where he talks about, like, lest sin creep in and destroy the good life God has planned for us. And it pans to Ellie. And I'm like, oh, she's the sinful lesbian who's going to ruin Astor's life. They're doing conversations while they're playing ping pong still. And he talks about how he's been riding to Wenatchee for his taco sausage. Ellie finds out that the other Munskies haven't tried the sausage, and she seems to soften there, and she says that she likes the name and the way Paul lights up. I really enjoy seeing how their relationship develops.
He doesn't know how to change his trajectory because his family hasn't ever tried anything different. But Paul is the one that's willing to.
Oh, Paul, you damn bastard.
I love that guy. So Paul asks about Ellie's mom, and to describe her to him, and I don't know that Ellie has ever talked about her mom with anyone else before, and she says she was young, funny, and dead. And I feel like that is so tragic, that to be able to even cope with her mom's death, the only thing that she's ever been able to tell herself is that she's just not here anymore. She's dead. Mm-hmm. Because she can't fully deal with it. And I just love that there's this subtle arc throughout the movie of Ellie dealing with her mother's death and how to actually fulfill that legacy.
So then when we go to Ellie and Astor talking late at night, I enjoyed the paralleling of both of them leaning up against a window, you know, as if they were facing each other, and they're texting. Later on, because it's like montage-y, I think. So Ellie ends up talking with Paul and is like, why do you like her? And he says that she's smart and pretty and she smells like flower. And I just think that's really adorable that he thinks that she smells like flower. And he's like, well, what else could I like about her? And then Ellie just goes into this, like, lesbian monologue.
The lesbian longing. It's like you're fucking reading Jane Eyre. And I'm like, this is what I love about the lesbian influence in this. Ellie loves how her eyes look right into yours, how she twirls her hair when she's reading. Her laugh breaks this perfect exterior. How she has five voices, and how you could live in an ocean of her thoughts, and it feels like she really knows you.
It's so fucking intense. Oh my God, Ellie. You damn gay mess. Like, it's so intense.
There's a specific way that women who like women appreciate women, and it's like just perfectly described in that sentence of longing, and I will fully appreciate that until my dying day.
It was so good. And then, like, Paul freaks out, and, like, for a split second, you know, Ellie and I think that Paul realizes, but instead he's just like, I'm so stupid, you're so much better at conveying emotions, and you don't even care about her.
When Ellie makes that revelation that, you know, you try harder than anyone I've ever met, with the exception of maybe my dad with my mom, to show a girl that you love them. And if love isn't the effort you put in, then what is it?
So they hang out some more. She ends up trying the taco sausage. They end up drinking Yakult. They end up watching that film where a woman is on the train and the guy's chasing after her. And Ellie's perception is he's a fucking moron. And Paul is like, he cares. She looks sad. And it's just, you know, very much them.
He's like, you're talking on the surface level, like, oh, it's just romantic. And when Ellie tries to discredit it, he's so intuitive. And he's like, yes, maybe that's true. Maybe they are both stupid, but look at how sad she is. Everything about this movie is seeing one part and then seeing the other half later.
It's so good. Brilliant. So then we go back to Ellie and Astor kind of texting and talking about, like, secrets. And Ellie says, no secrets, just a good guy. And I kind of perceived that as Ellie feeling a little bit guilty that she's in love with Astor, because Paul, it really is just a good guy.
I think Ellie at this point, this, it wants to put her own feelings aside because now she thinks that Paul deserves to have that love.
I agree. I think that she's like, you know, I like this girl, but like, one, it's not going to happen. And two, Paul deserves that. Like, he's so good.
And then at the same moment, that's when Paul starts to fully see Ellie as well when he hears her singing. So you see that look in his face too. And I think it's interesting that they, in different ways, they have that moment about the same time in the story.
They go on date number two. It's kind of awkward. So Ellie steps in, and I personally thought it was hilarious the way that this text conversation goes. So Ellie texts Aster and is like, sorry, I get nervous when you're around. And Aster's like, did you text me? And Paul's like, yeah, totally. And takes his phone off of the counter. And just the way that Paul keeps like staring at Ellie in the car, and he's like, what the fuck are you texting? And she's like, stop fucking looking at me. But I'm also like, Ellie, just give him a message and let him know what's going on. I'd be freaking out too.
Yeah, blind CC that bitch. Like, yes. What's happening? But what's kind of incredible to me is how much Paul trusts Ellie, because it seems like he has no idea about the conversations that they're having. You can see through this text conversation how much Aster really connects to Ellie romantically, but she thinks it's Paul. And she doesn't feel that in person. Like, you're seeing what she talks about later in the scene. And I love that Paul takes over and tries to speak Ellie's thoughts, but he can't quite get there.
And then Ellie's like watching this. And I imagine that it was particularly painful to see Paul, you know, quote unquote, win, that despite their lack of common interest, that despite his like difficulty and the awkwardness of their dates, that at the end of the day, he still gets the girl because he's a cute boy.
And also that Ellie has come to know and love Paul at this point. So even though she's heartbroken, she's okay with it. And she doesn't hold that against him. I think traditionally in other like media forms, like, you would see more of an animosity there. But the whole purpose of this movie is exploring love in many forms. And so we're really getting to see that here between Ellie and Paul.
So then they are shopping for this mandatory recital thingy. And Paul tells Ellie that he kissed Aster. Ellie's like, how the hell do you know when a girl wants to be kissed? Which Paul tries to explain to her and is like, she gives you a look and you just, you know it. And he's like, you look weird. Can I please choose your outfit for you?
Paul thinks this conversation is about Ellie, like, wanting to know when someone would kiss her, but she is having this conversation because she wants to know when to kiss a girl. And if that is not the epitome of what growing up in a closet is like, because I don't even think Ellie fully realizes it yet.
I see lesbians talking about how like they know that they're gay, they know that they want to kiss a girl, but they can't read the signal still, you know, because you're constantly uncertain as to whether or not it's what they want.
It's a complete revulsion of a system you've been trained to know, and there's no one to teach you how to understand the new system. So there's a lot of confusion there.
Yeah. So we go to the recital. Trigg is Mr. Popular. Some assholes fuck up the piano. And so when Ellie goes to play, it's like twanging. It's fucked up. And so
also, that's fucking school property, bitch. I would be pissed.
Paul grabs someone's guitar and like tosses it to Ellie and is like, sing your song. And I thought that it was really important that Ellie goes from playing the piano with her back to the audience to facing the audience as she performs this song.
Yeah. And it shows an interesting concept that she never gave people the opportunity to like her because she never opened herself up. But once she gave them an opportunity, they did like her. Which is interesting as how she evolves for the second part of the movie. Mm-hmm. She's like willing to take some more chances in her life that she never was. And this is kind of that starting point. I also just love the timing is that they make you wait just long enough to think that the audience might not like it. But then they do, and Ellie's surprised, and you're relieved as an audience member mm-hmm. that she is getting the moment she deserved.
And then Paul picks her up to go to a party. Everyone knows her as a Chinese girl. which annoys me, but again, is probably not unrealistic. I died laughter at that gamo who like is like, hey, Ellie, we've like been in school forever. Like your nails. Let's go play a game.
Maybe that's the other side of the logging or something. I don't know, but that was funny to me as well. She's like getting drunk and like living her best life and thinking she's in control of how drunk she's getting, but she's not. Like,
oh my God, she's so funny when she's drunk, where she's like, I know I have been drinking spirits. I'm having to pee more often than usual. I know I'm drinking. And Paul's like, you've had enough. Let's take you home. And she pukes and he tucks her into bed and it's adorable. And he sees in her bag that she's been writing to food critics on his behalf. He like leaves her aspirin and water for her to take the next morning because he knows she's going to be hungover. Ellie is taking her medicine when she hears Aster arriving and she freaks the fuck out and is like, I was just like, first of all, girl, you are moving way too fast for someone with a hangover.
That's what you could do when you're 18, I guess.
Aster is like kind of awkward. Ellie's kind of awkward. And she's like, oh my God, nothing's happening with Paul. Like he's 100% like interested in you.
Aster feels so much more connected to Ellie than she does Paul, but can't explain it. Like this is how, when she talks about later, how she always knew. Like this is one of those moments where you can see her like being so connected to Ellie, but not understanding why. Ellie completely understands the painting and how, you know, Aster has done these different strokes and she likes this one stroke that's off to the side that's lonely but hopeful.
Ugh, I know. Fucking Ellie with the shit she says. Aster definitely like that sticks with her. And Aster ends up inviting herself to hang out with Ellie and they go to the train station. Ellie ends up telling Aster the times in which she's doing the job. And I just kind of wondered if those times coincided with the times in which she and Paul are talking. And I wondered if that was any other kind of potential clue.
Ooh, interesting. Yeah. I like that.
Then Ellie like fucking isolates herself in the booth trying to stay away from Aster.
Why can't even deal with Ellie and this shit? But also I love how Aster feels free at this moment of the train and feels so in control. And she says it's like being master of the universe. And Ellie says a teeny tiny universe. And Aster says at least you rule something. Yes. And I think that's such an indicator for how out of control of her own life Aster feels.
Yeah, her life has already been determined for her and she does not get a say in it. She ends up inviting Ellie to go somewhere. This car drive, though. Oh, my God.
I have so much feeling about how Alice shot this.
Right?
It's like fully executed visually how Ellie feels about being in this moment with Aster.
Yeah, like as I was watching this, like the shots, the song, like I could feel
like,
that
you
feeling.
The shot took my breath away, which is so lesbian of me. Uh-huh. But Aster's hand on the wheel.
Yeah.
What the fuck about that moment? It was like the epitome of like lust.
Uh-huh. No.
Intention. It gave me goosebumps.
Yes, like he's right before that, I think, is like Ellie's like arm, like from like the side, and then it's Aster's hands. And I'm just like, oh my God, you're in a car, you're in very close proximity to the person you really want to be touching, but you cannot be touching. Like, it's so anxiety inducing in the best way possible. And I fucking loved it all.
This is like the visualization of longing.
So then we find out that they are going to Aster's favorite place, which is a hot spring. And fucking Aster, like if Ellie and I are not gay panicking enough, like,
ooh, girl,
she just takes her damn top off. And Ellie just was like, whoop, deciduous trees, huh?
This girl fucking actually strips.
Yeah. And I love it because I feel like that is such a realistic reaction, which is like, I think even before I realized I was gay and I was in these situations with other women, like my instinct was to turn away, you know, like to be respectful and you freak out.
I was like, bitch, I'm going to fully respect this woman and not scare her.
I love how like Aster's just like watching Ellie like freaking out and then like realizes. So she turns around. So then Ellie goes ahead and she like takes off some of her clothing and gets in.
She takes off her jacket.
Her hoodie. Yeah, that's all. She takes off her hoodie.
Listen, I also loved that Aster just like stripped down, because it also shows even though she feels disconnected, she's still like this incredibly like confident, self-aware person. It's like this analogy that Ellie is a person that Aster is willing to strip herself bare to, even if she doesn't realize it yet. As she's like kind of baring her soul to Ellie about her inner conflicts, that she's bare physically.
In here, we find out that like Aster was originally from California. She ends up making a joke about like, "Are you in long underwear?" And Ellie's like, "Yes." Aster pops out of the water to go ahead and get like a little radio
When
going.
Ellie almost has a fucking heart attack when Aster comes near her, I've
She's so
never.
close to her.
Girl, I felt Ellie in that moment. Like, I was with her. I was like, holy shit,
It intercuts a little bit with some Paul and Ellie's father stuff. So Paul takes sausages to Mr. Chu, and then we go ahead and we hop back to the hot springs. And Aster points out that she's never hung out with another girl and not talked about boys, and she finds it nice. But then they start talking about boys.
oh, and this is one of my favorite lines of the whole movie. Aster says to Ellie, "When I'm with Paul, he makes me feel safe. But when I write with him, he makes me feel unsafe." Whoo!
Yeah. And then Aster starts to talk about kind of how her life has been decided for her, where Trigg has been talking to her father about their future wedding that he's never talked to her about. And she says, "I should marry him, you know, right? And should I?" And then they start talking about God.
I love this conversation about God. It's the most relatable thing I've ever felt in my entire life. Ellie says that she doesn't believe in God, and Aster says it must be nice, and Ellie says it's not, it's lonely. Literally, everybody goes to that same fucking church in town. Like, that is the life where she grew up, but it's so disconnected from her culture. And her mom died when she was young, so why would she believe in God? Like, there's just so much to Ellie expressed in that moment.
So Aster ends up talking about how she had been asking God for a sign, and then that letter appeared, and she felt so understood. And she mentions that, you know, it's kind of silly. And then Aster kind of takes it from a serious topic to kind of silliness, where she's like, "Well, you know what is silly?" And she starts kind of pulling at Ellie's clothing, and is just like poking at fun at the fact that she's wearing layers. And Ellie's like, "I am a Russian doll of clothing." And I
That made
mean,
me laugh
it's
so hard.
adorable. It was so cute. But also I'm like, Aster, you cannot touch Ellie that way. Unless
Girl!
it's going somewhere.
But literally, in the next scene, when they're floating, it looks like Aster is wearing Ellie's clothes.
Yeah. I think that
I
she took
wish we
off
would
one
have
of
seen that shit.
I think she took off one of her layers, and I don't know how or why she put it on, but she's like, "We're sharing clothing already, honey."
As they peel layers off of each other, they become more connected. Paul asks about Ellie's mother, but the first insight that we actually get to Ellie's mother is what she talks to Aster. It's like the single connection she has left to her mom, which is Ellie's mom thought that every song, every movie, every story has the best part. And the song that's playing on the radio was one of her mom's favorite songs. And that's a very vulnerable thing to share the best part of your mom's favorite song with Aster.
Ellie feels so comfortable and connected to Aster that she is independently offering up information about her mother, which I think is in part her connection to Aster, but also potentially the work that she's done with Paul in becoming more comfortable and talking about her mother. And I just think that that's really beautiful.
The little bit about Paul and Ellie's dad going on is basically like this kind of like solitude they find in each other, even though they're not speaking, as like they're cooking together. And then Aster drops Ellie off, and Aster tells Ellie, "I hope you find something good to believe in."
I feel like that's a thing that like maybe deserves like some analysis, but I don't have anything. Do you have anything about it?
Well, I guess the concept is, what does Ellie find to believe in through the movie? And my argument, I guess it would be herself.
We see Aster go to Paul's place and she asks him about God. He says, of course he believes in God, and mentions that her painting was pretty. I just feel like Aster really, really has to know in this time, like, or at least has to have some strong questions.
I think in this moment, both conflicting forces within Aster are happening at the same time. I think Aster kisses Paul because she feels safe, but it's also to rebel because she's searching for this relationship with him that she has through words that she doesn't feel.
Interesting. I wondered if she was starting to have feelings for Ellie.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's part of it.
Yeah, and then like he answers in this way that is in opposition to who the written Paul is, and then like rather than kind of pursue this line of questioning, it's like, let me just shove it down and just kiss him. And like, it's that, let me direct the energies I was feeling for Ellie over here because this is safe.
Yeah, I think it's the juxtaposition of the two feelings towards Paul, in quotation, mm-hmm. She feels safe and unsafe. And she felt unsafe with Ellie, so she's searching for that in this kiss with Paul, but doesn't feel it, but feels that safe feeling at the same time, which allowed her to try to achieve it. But at the end of it, I think all she feels is lost because she doesn't get what she wants out of that kiss.
So it looks like Ellie sees the kiss. She knocks over her guitar or something. She sees that college application. Then we go over to the football game and Aster's in the stands. She says hi to Paul. He waves at her. Ellie comes in. They wave at each other and you see how much Paul lights up at seeing Ellie. They are kind of communicating with each other non-verbally where she's like, dude, the ball behind you. And he catches, he scores. And apparently this is the first time they score in 15 years. And so Ellie goes and ends up stocking up on Yakult. Paul like goes over and she's like, can you just like give me some? And it's like, it's such a friend interaction. Like, I love it. But then Paul tries to kiss her and she freaks the fuck out and drops all of her Yakult. And he's like, why not? Is there someone else? Because for him, that's the only possible reason that she would be saying no, because they've built up this relationship. Like, isn't this the natural progression of a male-female interaction?
Aster's there and sees the whole thing. Aster is upset. I don't think she knows why she's upset. She also sees Ellie not wanting it. But then we also see Paul not really caring about Aster's reaction.
Oh, I know. Paul was just like, nope, whatever.
The dramatic moment is actually between both Aster and Ellie and Paul, not Aster and Paul at all. Once he realizes that Ellie likes Aster, he's so shaken by it and says, but it's a sin. You're going to hell. And that is fucking harsh. He plays it in a way that makes me feel sympathetic to him, even though I'm like, that is one of the worst things to say to somebody. If I had a best friend tell me that, that would crush me.
I was so shocked by Paul saying this because they have this relationship, and I could only think about how Ellie must be feeling that the one person that she's actually developed a relationship with in this fucking town that she's been living in for how long says that to her. Like, how painful that must be. We end up seeing her walking home. She looks dejected and Trigg is there.
This is such a great moment of humanity and comic relief after a really heartbreaking scene.
So he thinks that Ellie's into him. And so then he like tries to kiss her, but the father sprays him with water, which I thought was hilarious. The quote, between the scenes for this one is hell is other people.
And that is the truth.
So we see that, you know, Paul is getting this recognition for what he did at the football game. And yet, you know, he's unhappy. Ellie is alone and unhappy. And Aster is surrounded by people and yet feels alone. So they are all feeling alone and miserable, and it's sad. We go to Paul's house where he's researching homosexuality. And because he is not a gay who's trying to hide his gayness, he does not realize he should close the browser and delete his history. So his mother sees it. Father can feel Ellie's kind of renewed quietness. Paul brings meat to Ellie's father and he asks if they've broken up. Paul informs him that they were never together, and Dad says she seems sad. Paul says to him, you don't see her, who she is, who she could be. And then Ellie's father ends up talking to him in Mandarin about the impact of the death of his wife when Ellie was 13 years old. Then in English, he says to him, have you ever loved someone so much that you don't want anything about them to change?
Maybe you view Ellie's father one way when you start the movie, but then you start to gain such an understanding of him as a person throughout it. Like, you learn about this best part thing with Ellie's mom and how you always see her father focusing on this best part. And you see this, like, tragedy that he's gone through in his life, but that in this moment he's still so earnest and loving his daughter and wanting the best for her, and how that gets a little bit misguided. But then this is also the thing that Paul needed to hear to fully accept Ellie. Well, then in that moment he has to accept that Ellie's gay because he loves her and he doesn't want anything about her to change. And if that is not a beautiful way about to, like, have a discussion with someone that's struggling with, you know, someone in their life being gay or different, I don't know what is.
This disruption to the norm that their life became after the mother's passing allowed, I think, Mr. Chu to talk about his wife's loss, even though Paul can't understand it. But probably my favorite fucking scene of this entire movie is this entire church ridiculousness. So we go to church and Trig reads one of the most overly utilized quotes about love, in my opinion. I don't like it. I think people use it too much. The love is patient, love is kind, blah, blah, blah. And he ends up proposing to Aster, who is clearly freaked the fuck out. And so she just kind of nods gently, like just like slightly in affirmation. And Ellie yells out, no!
Aster can't even say yes. Like, the poor thing. She almost got sucked into that shit.
And then Paul jumps in and he's like, he says he was pretending, and he basically does an apology to Ellie for thinking being gay is a sin in, like, you know, so many words, and talks about how there are so many ways to love and he can't imagine what it's like to have to hide yourself all the time. And so it's talking about her being gay, but also about non-romantic love.
It's also pushing Ellie to finally stop pretending as well. To fully realize her feelings for Aster out loud. Ellie cares enough about Aster that she doesn't want to see her fall into a life that she's not meant for.
Yeah. And she's struggling so hard with trying to say what love is. And I'm thinking that in part of it is because it's her first time experiencing love. And so she talks about how love is messy. It's horrible. It's selfish. It's bold. It's trying and reaching and failing and being willing to ruin your good painting for the chance at a great one. And she says to Aster, is this really the boldest stroke you can make? And this is the moment in which, with 100% certainty, Aster knows the truth. This is what I absolutely love. The way she's looking at Ellie, walks straight up to Paul and slaps the shit out of him, but all while staring at Ellie.
I just thought that was such a genius moment and such a twist on how these interactions usually go, because it's usually so embarrassing, but this wasn't about like a public shaming or anything. This was like simply about Aster's feeling, how betrayed Aster feels from Ellie. By slapping Paul, it was genius.
Then Paul's mother is like, Paulie, if you're gay, I can accept you. And he's like, I'm not gay, Ma, but I want to change the sausage recipe. She's like, how could you? And so then Ellie goes home and her father has made a shit ton of dumplings, basically saying that she should go to Iowa for college and be like her mother, not like him. And like I mentioned, there's a lot that my wife felt like she related to with this being in Asian household, but I think what stood out to her the most was this depiction of familial love that kind of stereotypically, and in her experience, her household didn't verbally communicate love, didn't say I love you, didn't talk about things in the way that others might expect to, but love is shown through acts of consideration. Ellie's father shows his love for his daughter in this preparation of dumplings, where he's making enough food for the train ride and telling her to go to Iowa and live her life. And Ellie shows her love for her father in calling the electric company, in taking on his duties at the engineering place. And up until probably that moment with her father, is planning on staying in Squamish and helping out and taking care of her family and what she has to do. She wanted to make sure that I noted the Asian Americanness that Alice hits on in depicting Ellie's family.
The quote break here being Ellie's quote that love is messy and horrible and selfish and bold. You know, the whole narration all along is Ellie not having her own point of view. We finally see what Ellie thinks about things herself, and we get to be like a fully realized version of Ellie. And I thought that was so clever.
Yes, and it's not only the development of her own opinion, but the assertion that her opinion is worth being noted in the same way all of these other people's. We see Aster, you see that the restaurant below her is called The Turning Point, which I thought was really interesting. Ellie is waiting for her, and Aster comes down and talks to her, says that she's been really busy applying for art school. Ellie starts talking about going to Iowa, and Aster's like, bye, like, we're not talking. And that's when Ellie apologizes, I'm assuming kind of for the first time. We have this kind of parallel of them on opposite sides of the street with the yellow line right down the middle. Aster says that deep down she probably knew, and they kind of joke a little bit about emojis. I think it's worth noting that Aster is having this conversation with her arms closed. Seems like she's closed off. And she says, it's not like it never crossed my mind. She says, if things were different or if I were different, and her arms kind of come down and she seems to be a little bit more open. So Ellie says, you could never be different. And I read it as like her being annoyed. And then Aster's like, what? And so then she starts, I feel like, kind of getting a little bit more jokey, where she's like, am I sure?
I feel like at this moment, Ellie has fully understood herself, and Aster's not quite there yet. So this is Ellie being realized Ellie and kind of calling Aster out in a fun way. And I literally think that at this moment in this conversation, Aster is only like putting her toe in the water at the possibility that she could be like gay or bi.
Well, I would agree with that based on what's said. So she says, you know, like, if things were different, if I were different. And then Aster says, I can be sure. In a couple of years, I'm going to be so sure. And I'm like, so sure of what? In a couple of years, you're going to feel comfortable saying that you're sure that you're not straight? I think this is when she ends up saying goodbye, and she calls her heathen. And my only note is like, who knew heathen could be a pet name?
You know, she says, find something good to believe in. And Ellie walks away, but she knows she got a look. But I think that could be said in the earlier scene where in the typical romance, Aster saying, I hope you find something good to believe in. That would have been a moment for Ellie to go for it and kiss Aster, but she was too afraid. But here is the moment where Ellie knows that she can't be afraid and she has to go for it. So she kisses her and says, see you in a couple of years. And in this moment, Aster looks the freest and happiest she ever has. In this moment, I think she fully accepts that she is different.
I think that old Ellie would walk away because she's become so realized and I think validated in who she is and feels like she's more worthy, that she goes ahead and she does this bold thing and is like, fuck it, I'm going to kiss her. Aster doesn't push her away. I mean, yes, she's not like holding on to her and making out with her, but she doesn't push her away. She accepts that kiss. And Ellie says to her, I'll see you in a couple of years. And then paralleling that to when she says, you know, in a couple of years, I'm going to be so sure. And I'm like, okay, so when you're out, that's when Ellie's going to come back.
You know, the only bursts of happiness that you see of Aster throughout this whole movie is when she is connecting with Ellie. I really, truly wonder if Aster would fully commit to that journey if Ellie didn't kiss her here. Like, this kiss was such a moment of realization that not only Ellie needed to complete her journey, that Aster needed too.
The smiles on both of their faces. So like you said, this is the first time we see Aster like full on smiling and really being happy. And it's the first time we see Ellie, who's riding away on her bicycle, smiling.
Feel like confident and secure in who she is and what she's worth.
And free.
And it's like a realization of that longing that's very satisfying. Like, they're both longing for something different. And Ellie achieves that in the kiss, but the kiss is what helps Aster achieve the longing and realizing she can lead a different life. And it's just glorious how that moment comes together for each of them and propels them on their own journeys.
So then we go to the final goodbye. Paul and Ellie are standing outside by a train. He's sending her off with some food. Her father is inside in like a nice outfit. We see that he's now using the train signals that he formerly did not trust.
And I think it's just lovely that Aster, Ellie, Paul, and her father, all the major loves in Ellie's life, get this like fully realized arc in the movie. Like, I'm not left wondering. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just so nice to see that, because in the end, it's not just about Ellie and Aster, it's about all of them.
I love this at the end where, you know, Paul's clearly very emotional. Ellie tries to play it off. She gets on the train and Paul chases after that train and she's laughing and sobbing and he's just smiling like the dork that he is. Yes, he's a moron, but doesn't it make you feel loved is my note to Ellie.
The whole notion behind running after a train is Ellie always thought that it was dumb and stupid because you could never catch up to the train. But Paul understands that even if you don't catch up to the train, the running means something. Love is effort. And that's kind of the whole arc there. And Ellie finally realizes that at the end.
I'm curious about this. So afterwards, the camera pans forward and it's at all the other people on the train. Why do you think that it pans forward in that way?
I think that's Alice's perspective of Ellie being a background character and you never know what their journey is. And I think that's kind of what that's saying. Like, we don't know what these people's journeys are, but we should care about them all the same, just like we do Ellie.
That is a great interpretation. I was trying to figure out why, and I was like, is it this feeling of like newness, like she's around these new people and she's going somewhere unknown? But it didn't feel right, and I couldn't put my finger on what it was, but it seems like such, you know, it's such an intentional choice in what they did that I knew I was missing something. And I think that's a great point, which is they're all just people on a train, and we don't know what any of their stories are. I think that it's also important that everyone else on the train was white. And so when we stop and consider, you know, whose story is worth listening to or worth like paying attention to, it doesn't often go to the young minority girl.
It's a concept, I think, where we could have picked anybody on this train to tell a story about. But typically, Ellie would just be the token character in the background, but we chose to tell her story. And I think that's a really beautiful ending to the movie. And that brings us to the topic of discussion to close us out is, what do we feel, because this was coming of age, not a rom-com, that we don't see Aster and Ellie deciding to be together at the end of the movie? Some people wish they had it. Some people are okay with it. Where do you stand on all of it?
So I think that, of course, obviously, I would love for them to be together. I always want to have two women together and happy and blah, blah, blah. But I don't think that happy ending up together stories for two women are the only sapphic stories I want to see. My point just being that I think that sometimes people are quick to shit on something because you're not getting what you want and not because it's an appropriate criticism of what was provided. I think that this film was done beautifully well and illustrates all of these different kinds of loves, and I don't feel like I'm leaving there with lacking. I think that it portrayed exactly what it intended to in a really well done way, and I feel very satisfied.
Although I love to see happy relationships, when it comes to storytelling, I'm always so much more invested in the buildup because it's hard to deliver an interesting relationship once people are together, because there's so much tension in the buildup that really draws you in and that you connect with and that like just like resonates with your body when you're like watching something. And it's harder to keep up that tension when people are together. So for a movie that's essentially all about the buildup, like, it's no wonder that I would really become obsessed with it because there's so many interesting dynamics at play. But in the same token, like, I understand that we don't really see that fully happy ending where the girl gets the girl and that's the end. So I get where people are coming from, where that's what they really want to see. And I don't think there's anything wrong with wanting that. But I always come from the perspective that I much rather fall in love with a story, even if it's not what I may want. Like, because the story ended up giving me everything I wanted anyway.
Yeah, I think it's about having appropriate expectations. If this were supposed to be a romantic film, like if this was it, I would have expected to see much more of them in a relationship, even if they didn't end up together. But because I knew this was a coming of age story, my expectations were there, and it completely checked all of those boxes.
And I know Alice doesn't do sequels, but I would be so thrilled if there was a sequel and we could actually see a moment of Aster and Ellie coming together. But in the same breath, I just feel so wholly satisfied that I think I'm okay with it being left to interpretation on whether you think they do see each other in a couple of years type of a thing.
If there was a sequel, I would obviously love it. I would watch it. I'd be very, very happy. But I think that I'm also very content to them not doing a sequel, especially when I think about this as a coming of age story. And I think about trying to tell an authentic and true story, which I don't think that people very often end up with their first mm-hmm. love. And so I don't know that I believe that Ellie and Aster are going to end up together.
That's why I like it, because you can live in that moment of fantasy and think they end up together, and you also get tied to the reality that they might not. And I think it the way it ends, you're able to live in both of those worlds.
And it really draws me back to when Ellie writes on that painting where she says all beautiful things, you know, get ruined or come to an end or whatever it may be. And I had said that just because something existed and ended doesn't mean that there's no more happiness and wonderfulness out there. The story for me is Ellie goes off to college as a self-realized person who has more understanding of herself and more confidence in herself, and she's ready to live her out life. And I think that they played the role in each other's lives that they were meant to, and hopefully Aster is on that trajectory of understanding herself and accepting herself, and she can live that life that she determines for herself and not that's been chosen for her. And I think that's a good story. I'm happy.
How many people are there in your life that have had a profound impact on you? You know, whether that interaction with them was big or small, but you still carry that with you to this day. And it's still very important to you. But they have no idea of their importance in your life because you mm-hmm. don't have a relationship anymore. And where do you fit into somebody else's life in the same respect? Like, you don't know. And I think that's kind of what this movie is about. I'm very happy with this movie. I loved it. And I hope you all did too. And I hope you enjoyed this conversation.
If you all have other things that you want to chat about, you know, you can find us on Twitter at This Lesbian Shit.
Please share with us any wonderful revelations about this movie, because there's so many layers to it. I mean, great job, Alice.
Yes, thank you, Alice. Can't wait for the next thing. Please don't let it be another 15 years. All right, bye, guys.
Bye.
This Lesbian Ship is Intense is a part of the Frolic Podcast Network. Find more podcasts you'll love at frolic.media/podcasts.